Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, genealogical research seems to be making a comeback as more and more people want to get in touch with their ancestry in a day and age when family storytelling is increasingly a rarity. My guest today tells a story of detective work on what was considered her family's black sheep and found that a remarkable, if unconventional, story emerged. The Binghams of Louisville may not be that well known today, but through the 20th century they were the owners of an important media empire and had enormous political clout in Kentucky and around the country. Emily Bingham heard plenty of stories about her family growing up, but none about her great-grandaunt, Henrietta, who died when Emily was three. Emily's curiosity eventually grew to a fascination, and with that came warnings from the family about exploring further. But as she did explore further, she found a remarkable woman steeped in the headiest part of the jazz age, a Southern debutante who learned the saxophone and promoted black musicians, who consorted with the artists of Bloomsbury in London. Henrietta was unconventional by the standards of the unconventional of that particular age, who was the bon vivant of every party and attracted lovers of both sexes, from actress Hope Williams to actor and producer John Houseman, to tennis star Helen Hull Jacobs, to Bloomsbury artists Stephen Tomlin and Dora Carrington. Emily Bingham recounts the story of her great-grand-aunt in Irrepressible, the jazz age life of Henrietta Bingham that brings a whole age to life. Emily Bingham is the author of Mordecai, an Early American Family, and the co-editor of The Southern Agrarians and the New Deal, Essays After I'll Take My Stand. And her latest book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Emily Bingham, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your first book was a family history, but it was of an early Jewish American family that settled in America in the first century of the country. What led you to investigate your own family tree and of one person in particular, a great grandaunt named Henrietta Bingham?
She was grand, and she was great. Yes, so she was the older sister of my grandfather, to whom I was real close growing up, but I never knew Henrietta. She died when I was only 3 years old, so I didn't have a chance to know her. But it was really one of these cases where, and I think this is not uncommon, where the fact that so little was said about her formed the base of my later curiosity. I mean, as children, we don't know how to question or interrogate silence. But as I got older, I did hear a few stories about Henrietta, and the ones I heard just intrigued me, or they kind of stunned me. And on the intriguing side, I learned that she spent time in London in her early 20s with the likes of Virginia Woolf and her circle of amazing Bloomsbury artists and writers, creative people. But then on the shocking side, I was interviewing my grandmother for just a family oral history in her 80s. And this was back when I was a graduate student in history, and I just thought, I ought to do this. And she, in an aside about her sister-in-law, said, "Oh, you know, she was an invert." I didn't know quite what to say after that, because I'd never heard the word, but, you know, sometimes you know what a word means even when you haven't ever heard it before. And that was one of those cases, and, you know, that stopped me, and I remembered the laden nature of that comment. It was a late 19th century word to describe someone who is attracted to members of their own sex.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that must have taken you aback.
It did. And I, you know, it wasn't like I had never heard that she might, you know, that might have, or that was so shocking, but it just, I don't just hear that label and understand a little about what it might have felt like to be labeled that way. It did leave an impression. But I just, when I was having children in the late 90s, all those Victorian names started getting popular, and I thought, you know, let's get a Sophie in the family. And then I kept getting so many Sophie birth announcements that I said to my husband, "We can't do that." And that led us to think, well, let's just use this Henrietta name. It's a beautiful old name, and why not? But the reaction that provoked told me that there was an even bigger story I didn't know.
Well, I guess really the beginning of really knowing the story started with the birth of your child, but it really concluded when I think a relative said, you ought to go up to the attic. There's a trunk or two up there.
Yes. So my father, who was not so happy about the naming, but came around very nicely, he gave me a tip. It was really a week before he died. He said, I know you're looking into Henrietta, my aunt, his aunt, my great aunt. And, you know, you probably ought to just look in the attic. I think there's an old trunk up there. And sure enough, I went up and I did peek into it. And it was a jumble of old personal belongings, old medicines, old clothes, old shoes and hats and socks and things like that. And I thought, okay, I'll come back one day and I'll really look at it. But there's nothing, there's no diary, there's no letters. And so finally, after going to various archives to track Henrietta down in other people's letters, I had a day and I went to this garret room in this third floor of a mansion and overlooking the Ohio where I grew up and Henrietta also spent much of her life. And that there I found at the very bottom, not of the original trunk, but of another trunk in that room, a stack of letters, about 200 in their envelopes with the postmarks from two men who she almost married in the 1920s.
And one of them was the famous actor John Houseman.
Exactly, and people might remember him from his Smith Bonney commercials in the 70s, but also he won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Charles Kingsfield, the irascible professor in The Paper Chase. Before that, though, he was a fantastic producer and director working with Orson Welles all through the 1930s.
Mercury Theater, The War of the Worlds, yeah.
Exactly. That was him producing. Really interesting man. And what I learned was that when he was courting Henrietta and they almost married, he wasn't in the theater at all. He was an aspiring creative artist. He'd written novels unpublished, but was a grain trader, a profession that his Jewish father had pursued, who had come to America to try to corner the grain market, frankly, for a British firm. And he fell in love with Henrietta so hard in 1925 in Manhattan. And the stories he wrote about her, both, you know, in the letters, but also in his memoirs, especially the pages he decided to cut from his memoirs, were just phenomenal, and it put on display not only her amazing powers, but his own beautiful filmic eye. Because, for instance, he talks about driving in the open gray Chrysler from Lower Manhattan, where she lived in Greenwich Village, all the way to 125th Street, where they went into the, you know, the small paradise, all the great Harlem Renaissance cafes and nightclubs, with a massive silver flask sitting on the seat between them, and she would cover 13 blocks without hitting a stoplight. She went so fast.
Well, and what those letters make apparent was that Henrietta had this incredible life force that some people you run into meet, that just everybody wanted her. And the other thing you found in that trunk was a set of several tennis outfits, I believe. Right?
Exactly. So on the one side, I had these love letters from men, and on the other, I had a physical item, which was a bunch of tennis clothes, including some that were monogrammed with the initials HHJ, and also a lot of tennis shorts with a prominent blue stripe down the side. These are handmade, clearly tailor-made shorts. Now, I had heard from other sources that Henrietta had a friendship, some kind of a relationship with a tennis player from the 1930s who was, in fact, number 2, 1, 2, or 3 in the world during this period. So she was sort of the Martina Navratilova of the 1930s. Helen Hall Jacobs was her name. And she was American, Californian, and the first woman to wear shorts on the court in a major tournament. So I thought, well, these shorts are exactly like the ones she wore, and here's a shirt with her monogram. I better get these to the right place. And so I got in touch with the Tennis Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island, and made a donation of them, since they were famous shorts. And the curators finally got back thanking me and said, oh, yes, and these will add nicely to our Helen Hall Jacobs collection. Well, duh, it had never crossed my mind that there might be archival materials there relating to Helen Jacobs. And sure enough, when I went there, as soon as my legs could carry me, I found boxes of her diaries, her scrapbooks, and photo albums, and Henrietta was written through the lines of her diaries for 5 years. Sometimes things were scratched out because they were sensitive or sexual in nature, but often I could read under the scratch outs.
And what you found was that she was just this amazing bon vivant that just attracted people to her, and had lesbian affairs. She had had her sexual affairs, almost married a couple of them, and was just right in the middle of this jazz age. And even though she grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, which, you know, was a bastion of segregationism at the point, she learned to play saxophone. She entertained African-American musicians and was sort of a champion of them. She was just an amazing, amazing woman.
I know, and I love that aspect of her. One of the things, if I could wish for something to add to this book, it would be, oh, the letters of people like Florence Mills or Count Basie, because I think they knew her. I think Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey, if they didn't know her, she sure knew them. She went to see them sing. And, you know, the Prove It On Me blues and songs like that were songs that Henrietta took into her heart. She felt the blues herself in her own way. I think she identified with some of the suffering that she also realized was separate and different for African Americans, that she, as someone experiencing discrimination in her own, even very privileged life, I think she identified. And she also was an advocate for racial liberation. And again, I wish I had more documentary evidence on that, but even the little tidbits I have are very suggestive, and it makes me very proud. And she, for instance, was an enormous fan of Florence Mills, who sadly was never recorded but was acknowledged in the 20s as just, you know, one of the great stars of stage and song in Harlem, Midtown, and then all the way through Europe.
Now, for those who don't know the Bingham family of Louisville, it's a very prominent family. It owned two newspapers. It was, I suppose, it's one of those families that sort of define the culture of a place. Tell us a little bit about the Bingham family of Louisville.
Well, Henrietta's father was named Robert Worth Bingham, and he was born and grew up in North Carolina, coming from a long line of very respected school teachers, and they ran boarding schools for boys starting in the 18th century and running up into the 20th century. But Robert Worth Bingham wasn't satisfied with a life as a schoolmaster, and he got out of North Carolina on his engagement to a daughter of a wealthy Louisville manufacturer. In any case, he had high ambitions, and Henrietta was, you know, one of the things he was ambitious about, but he also wanted to be a politician. And it was really his second marriage to the heir to Henry Flagler's wife, Mary Lily Keenan, that catapulted him into wealth. And that enabled him to buy in 1917 two Louisville newspapers and set himself up as a publisher and political kingmaker and progressive reformer for the state of Kentucky with quite a grand vision. He wanted Henrietta to follow him in those footsteps, but for various reasons that didn't happen. And the family did continue to own and publish those papers and adding other media properties, TV and so forth, through the 20th century until 1986, when they were broken up and sold in the wake of some family disputes.
Yeah. Now, what was Henrietta's father's take on Henrietta's behavior? She, she had the typical genteel upbringing, I think, although she had some family tragedies early in life. She went off to Smith College, and that's really when her eyes were opened.
Yeah. You know, she met in her freshman year English class, the professor was a very dazzling, very intellectual, and very restless herself, young woman named Minna Kirstein, and she had only graduated from Smith 4 years earlier, so she was not much older than Henrietta, in fact, and they fell in love. They started an affair. I think this was probably pretty dangerous stuff to be mixing with, and Minna was brought a sort of radical leftist and Freudian sophistication to Henrietta's world.
And Lincoln Kirstein was her brother, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. So people may have heard of Lincoln Kirstein, a fantastic sort of eminence in the 20th century cultural history of New York, especially. He brought Balanchine to America and started the New York City Ballet and had a hand in starting the Museum of Modern Art. So just as my grandfather had this wonderful older sister, Henrietta, Lincoln had a wonderful older sister named Minna, and that was her introduction to college, I suppose. And it wasn't too long before Minna took her abroad to London with her on a sabbatical year, basically.
And when they were in London, they found themselves in the company of the Bloomsbury set, and sort of the hit of a good part of the Bloomsbury set. There were some that didn't care for her that much, but others were absolutely smitten with her.
Right. And
both men and women.
Yeah, yes, for sure. And don't forget that the Bloomsbury set is, we know that Americans are not always highly regarded by the Brits. Well, if that's the general rule, I would say the Bloomsbury set expressed that in spades. So there was a resistance, let's just say, to Americans. But Henrietta overcame that in almost every case. There was a very funny anecdote that I came across in a letter of one of the Bloomsbury folks that at their weekend house, where many of them would go for these parties in the country, Henrietta would come out and join them. And this man writing said that there was only one bed in the house where she could have had a quiet night, and that was Lytton Strachey's.
Who was gay?
Who was gay.
Well, in the course of the book, you have all these wonderful letters, which is really the main way of scholarship, and diaries. And the reaction to people first meeting her was just really amazing. It was almost like she was like they were like moths to a flame.
Yes, one man called her an oasis. You know, I treasured that I had a chance to bring that concept of her to life a bit. It's hard in history, even with people about whom a lot is known. We don't always know what they were like to be with physically. And Henrietta, not just sexually, though that's certainly part of it, had an allure in her, the way she was with people. It was her beautiful eyes. It was the way she made everyone feel intimate. It was her fun and her laugh and her deep, caressing voice of the South. It was her willingness to pick up a saxophone when proper girls were not supposed to do that. All these things that she did with her body and her spirit just seemed to wash over almost everyone around her. And to be able to bring that back is just a rare thing in any biography.
And we should also mention her spirits, because she apparently won a few friends with her cocktail mixing skills.
Yeah. So coming from Prohibition-era America, she had learned lots of good ways to consume not very tasty spirits. And so she brought those skills with her to London and wowed people with cocktails that I think got them drunker faster than they were probably used to.
Well, now, one of the things that you found, these great trove of letters, and you found some archives where she's mentioned, what's equally interesting is where she's not mentioned. You mentioned the fact that John Houseman, you had to go back to the original manuscripts to see the references to Henrietta Bingham. Minna Kirstein, who they spent a number of years together, were probably lovers, excised all references to her.
I know. And Minna was someone who decided, even though they had a physical and relationship and then a long friendship for years and years, Minna decided early on that to be seen as a lesbian was simply, as she put it, no way to go through life. it was not going to work for her. It just guaranteed her being viewed as an outsider. And Minna already felt like an outsider. She was Jewish, and that was hard enough. So she went about trying to banish any rumor about that in her own biography. She also did everything she possibly could to dissuade her brother Lincoln from pursuing his same-sex loves and life, which was a hopeless task. But in Henrietta's case, she also tried to get Henrietta into psychoanalysis and have her turn away from this behavior. But Minna left a very voluminous and lovely archive to her alma mater, Smith College, where she also taught for many years. And I went through it just as carefully as I could. And the only thing that I found written about Henrietta in that entire collection was one passage tucked into the back pages of a teenage journal. It wasn't even a journal she was keeping at the time, in which she wrote about how brilliant Henrietta's mind was and how she had loved her as she never had loved and probably never would love anyone else again.
Wow. Wow. That was a good find then. My guest today is Emily Bingham, a historian whose latest book is about her own family history, the story of a great-grandaunt, Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you're learning more about this and telling her story, I was really struck by the fact that, you know, it's a kind of a tragic story in a way, because she's flourishing during the Jazz Age, yet she, you titled the book Irrepressible, she was irrepressible, but eventually that all caught up with her, didn't it?
It did, and I think that had a great deal to do with the times. Richie, think about it, she was coming of age, she was born in 1901. She came of age right with the Jazz Age. And that was a particular era. It was our first sexual revolution of the 20th century, the second one being the 1960s. She was able to find enclaves and inhabit a cultural space that was so much more permissive than what came before it, certainly in the Victorian era, and also, ironically, it's hard, you know, things don't move in a straight line, really, to what came after. And so by the late 30s and 40s, the mood of the nation had changed, partly due to the Depression, partly due to war, partly due to aspects of psychoanalytical thinking that were absorbed in sort of homophobic ways. And she found herself back in the United States in a rural setting outside of Louisville, Kentucky, trying to run a thoroughbred horse farm. And she also had lost the protection of her very powerful father, who died in 37. And Helen Jacobs said that when she went to the hardware store in the nearby town to get supplies for the farm, that she felt, quote, queer, close quote. And I think these women were in some ways tolerated, but in other ways there was not a way to be kind and open around the life they were trying to lead. And so that combined with the effect of World War II. World War II for Henrietta meant growing hemp on her horse farm instead of horses so much, because the war effort required hemp, the supply had been interrupted, and she actually has a certificate saying she has permission to grow marijuana, which is pretty great, because, of course, it was illegal by then. But it also meant an interruption in her ability to go to New York and see all her friends in the theater, Kit Cornell and people like that, and her ability to go abroad and see her friends in Paris and London. So she was kind of marooned, and everyone else was off fighting the war. And I think this corresponded with her, you know, wondering how she was going to get through life, and it wasn't the roaring 20s anymore, and she was getting older, and she took to the bottle.
Mm. Yeah, earlier when we were talking about psychoanalysis, she underwent psychoanalysis, and I guess you found some notes, is that right?
I did. So one of the huge finds in my, you know, long mining session with Henrietta's story came from a place called the British Psychoanalytical Institute and their archives. And there had been a little bit written about the relationship between Bloomsbury and psychoanalysis. It was actually Virginia Woolf and her husband's press that published Freud in English. And so there was a long association between these literary figures and this movement. And in a footnote in a book about that, I saw that Henrietta Bingham sort of crossed into that world of psychoanalysis. And I was able to receive a pack of photocopies from the archivists there in London of letters that both Henrietta and Minna had written to the Dr. Ernest Jones, who was really the premier shrink in London in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. He wrote Freud's biography. He was the head of all the professional associations of this fledgling, really a fledgling movement. And yes, she was in analysis with him for multiple years on and off. And it was perhaps the most revealing, perhaps, and stunning was the 12-page letter that her professor, Minna Kirstein, wrote to Jones in the summer of 1923, saying, describing Henrietta and laying out her case history and asking if he would take her on to help address her neuroses, her anxiety, and her homosexuality.
Hmm. Must have given you great insight into who Henrietta was. Or was it jaundiced by the way psychoanalysis was in those days?
Well, you know, I have no notes from Ernest Jones even of his sessions with Henrietta. And if I could be in there with them, that would be, just a completely different perspective, because then I presumably would be able to hear more about her voice. But for instance, he did tell Minna in a letter, and there were no boundaries in those days around talking about your patient's cases, because he went ahead and reported regularly to Minna about his progress with Henrietta. He said a couple things. She's doing well, making progress. I'll be able to bring her from women to men. And the lucky man who has her, because of her deep capacity for love and her unbelievable charm.
Oh, my gosh.
But he also said she had a dream about a horse that she wanted to take home to Kentucky with her, and we decided that that was me. Ernest Jones, Dr. Jones.
That's hilarious. The name of the book is Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. Emily Bingham, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Historian Emily Bingham is the author of Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, you can go to our new website within publicradiotulsa.org. It's called studiotulsa.org, and you can look up some of our previous programs and listen on demand. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.